wrote up a lot of things I've talked to you about.
Great.
And I have a Agnes, did you redo some of this already?
Not a software changes this morning.
Yeah, I have a couple of little
changes.
Like on this page 2, page 3. Maybe you can just quickly page 4. And you can quickly just modify them and then we'll just sort of finish that off.
Okay.
So that's a written thing that is not complete because I'm going to continue to work on it and send it to you.
Oh, great.
Because I thought it would be good for me to put down in my own words what I thought, what was going on. But a lot of what I've talked to you about today had to do with that. And I started remembering all the details of these things, including the political situations at PerkinElmer and how that influenced things and kind of interesting stuff.
Mm. Very much so.
That's one of the things that you get into in a large organization, that you try to get something accomplished and it's so difficult because somebody can just put the clamper on it and nothing will happen.
Hmm.
I'm just curious, when Nimitz was president of the company, did you feel he was a overall positive?
Oh, absolutely. Actor? Yes, he was very positive. He made things happen and he was... You could talk to him, and he would relate to and respond well to good ideas. Horace McDonald was not; he was definitely not that way. And previous president Bob Lewis was also in that vein of being just a good guy in terms of accepting ideas. Dick Perkin was not really interested in the analytical business at all, other than getting involved in it, and somebody talked him into it. He was so interested in astronomy and telescopes and actually government business associated with bomb sites and stuff like that. That's where he spent most of his thinking, but he supported the analytical business. He left it pretty much in the hands of Van Zandt Williams to move along and to make things happen. And Van had quite a good group of people working for him that made push things along, so made it happen. But he resigned from the company in the early 60s, I believe. I don't exactly when things had not fully happened yet. And he took a job as president of the American Physical Society, I believe. And he enjoyed that because he was in contact with all of his fellow physicists and he traveled around and did stuff, and he had a lot of contacts in England and Europe and so forth. And he was a charming guy, great sense of humor, and he was well thought of by everybody who knew him, and he dropped dead in London around that time, around 61, 62, something like that. May have been 1960. And boom, he's gone. So he was quite a contributor in general to the entire field of infrared. And as were a lot of guys, but I think he was the great person to pass the word to the chemical industry that this is an area that they should be paying a lot of attention to. And the more he talked, the more attention they paid. And it became pretty standard for them to set up labs for infrared spectroscopy. And then when we did the Model 137, that became the bench chemist's infrared, so any chemist could have his own infrared spectrometer and do work on his own project at that time. So that was the thought that we had, that would be a good thing to do. The thing that Paul Wilkes was pushing for, which was the low-cost version of the Model 12 would never have accomplished that. But the miniature version of the Model 21, which was just a simple thing that had a little cam thing in it, so forth, that was it. That was the breakthrough. I don't know how many they sold. Probably a couple of thousand of those. I don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They sold more than they did the 21, that's for sure.
Did they?
I think so. They made that for the longest time. I think they stopped production of the Infracore
in Europe, too.
In something like 63 or something like that. I think it was 57 they came out with the 137, and they produced it for 7 years or something like that. Well, it was an inexpensive instrument, so it's not surprising that they would sell
about,
more than the 21.
It was about 200 a year, so you're right. There was quite a few. Not as many as the Model 21, though.
No?
No.
I would say that in cost of sales, I mean,
the
revenue, the 21 was much better.
Yeah.
But the Infracore, I thought, in terms of numbers...
I don't know what the number is, and there's no way of finding out now because it's all gone. But I thought it was somewhere around 8,000.
Well, that's an interesting question, actually, to go
and the into. And the 137, I would might be half that many.
Really?
Yeah. It was popular, but it wasn't that popular. There weren't that many chemists who wanted to be able to do their own infrared. The same problem has arisen in mass spectrometry right now.
Mm-hmm.
There are mass spectrometer labs, I financed the one at Stanford, that have guys who are really brilliant mass spectrometer people running them. But if you take the human brain, there are probably several million proteins that have to be identified. And there's no way that these biologists can run mass spectrometers. So what is needed is a mass spectrometer system where you plug in the protein and it prints out a report that goes onto the computer of the guy who's interested with the best guess as to what the protein structure might be. And that's in the works. There's a guy named Al Burlingame at the University of California, San Francisco, who's trying to build a computer system to do that. And I financed a lot of the work on that in that area. And the same thing is true in the mass spectrometer lab at Stanford. And these guys are just becoming aware of how important it is to identify the protein. The Human Genome Project, okay, but not important. The thing that's important is to identify the proteins that are in these genomes and be able to identify what they do and how they do it. A good example of that is mad cow's disease.
Mm-hmm.
Mad cow's disease is caused by a particle which nobody knew existed before. And what it is it's a protein that gets folded. And when it gets folded, it changes its structure in your brain and makes you go mad.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a cow. And some human beings as well. And just to be able to understand that there is such a thing, and there's more than just viruses and bacteria and so forth, is a very big thing. So that's all mass spectrometry, because it's the only technique that is sensitive enough to do protein work and be able to identify and do structural analysis.
Mm-hmm.
The early work that was done with Klaus Biemann, which he made such a huge contribution to, was just the whole business of how do you interpret mass spectra and end up with a structure from the mass spectrum that can only result from a particular group of masses. So that's now coming along at a great rate, and the whole area of proteomics is involved in that. I don't know whether, I think that maybe some of those guys at the old Perkinomer, who are now down in Foster City here, must have some thoughts about the whole area of mass spectrometry and its move from the early crude days to now. It's a very sophisticated thing.
We haven't had a real focused conversation yet about the course of gas chromatography. at PerkinElmer, which, you know, happened during your mm-hmm. time there.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could tell us about that and also the story of how the triple stage GC fits into that
okay.
progression.
Harry Hausdorff, who had demonstrated the infrared spectroscopy stuff at PerkinElmer and was enough of an infrared spectroscopist so he could then assist customers in interpreting their results and so forth, moved on to Europe to build up the sales organization in Europe. And the story that I understand it is that we had a consultant at Oxford, his name was Tommy Thompson, who told Van Williams that there was this new technique that had been developed in England that PerkinElmer should look into. So the next time that Van Williams went to England, he stopped by and visited Thompson, and then he had Harry Hausdorff join him. And they collected some papers and they visited somebody at Oxford who was doing work in gas chromatography. So I didn't know anything about it. They came back from, and Harry arrived, came back, flew back, and started making a lot of noise about this is very important. And so he considered that it was such a simple thing to do that PerkinElmer ought to be able to do it real fast. So they put together a group of people, and Van Williams supported it, and Harry was an important part of the early days of that and actually gave some papers. And then it landed rather quickly in my applications engineering group.
Mm.
And Harry went back to Europe. He needed to push it over there, but there was no champion at PerkinElmer other than a couple of the engineering guys who were working on it. So I brought in Nat Brenner and hired him, Nathaniel Brenner, into my applications engineering group to take over applications engineering work on gas chromatography. And he did a wonderful job, and he gave a lot of papers, and he wrote a lot of papers. And because it was such a ripe field, so many things to be done. And at the same time, I had been in very close contact with a consultant of ours who was a very famous guy. His name was Marcel Golay.
Oh, sure.
G-O-L-A-Y. And he would visit the company as a consultant about once a week.
Hmm.
So we had a session in which we talked about gas chromatography on a theoretical basis, and he didn't know anything about it. He wasn't very interested in it, actually. But as we talked, and we talked about how does it work and what's the fundamentals of the thing, he came up with an idea. So he went away. Next week he came back and he said, gas chromatography is nothing more than a telephone system. What does that mean? He said that that as the molecules pass from one thing to another, it's like a telephone system. And he did the equation, he'd done all the equations, and he published a paper on this. He didn't publish a paper. I had been asked to run the first gas chromatography symposium at Michigan State University for the Instrument Society of America, and I was supposed to figure out who's going to give papers and things. So I had several PerkinElmer guys and other people, and I invited the guy who invented it, H.E.B. Martin, to fly from England and give a talk on it. And I asked Marcel Golay to give a talk on his theory about how gas chromatography really works. By that time, he'd concluded that the way it was designed by the guys in England was completely wrong and shouldn't be done with this big packed column, but it should be a very thin capillary with stuff on the walls, which turned out to be correct.
Mm.
And he then had some guys make some runs for him on that stuff, and he showed that he had about 10 times higher resolution with his system than those they had ever shown. So he got up and gave his paper on, I think he called it gas chromatography and the telegrapher's equation. And I don't think anybody really understood it, except much later. Brilliant guy, Marcel Gallet. Anyway, that was an interesting story about gas chromatography. But Perkin Elmer then proceeded to build the first Gallet columns and to build the gas chromatographs based on that, which was really pushed Perkin Elmer way out in front. And they had a hell of a business, and they had about 85% of the gas chromatography business by, when was it? The end of the 50s, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of work was done at Perkin Elmer, and a lot of people got involved because it became a very big part of their business. I kind of got away from it, and then when I got into Japan and so forth and so on, there was still work going on. Nathaniel Brenner was still involved in it. But there was a strategic error made. There was a guy at DuPont who built a gas chromatograph in which he, instead of having a fixed temperature, he programmed the change in the temperature of the column, which caused certain components to come out faster.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you had a thing that took an hour to come out of the gas chromatograph, that wasn't very helpful. But by raising the temperature, you could make that come out, so you could have these components all squeezed together with the temperature programming. Well, somehow or other, the guys at Perkin Elmer decided that was for the birds, that the loss of resolution caused by that was so bad that it was a poor thing to do.
Hmm.
So there was a company down near there in Wilmington.
Yeah. F&M.
F&M Scientific. F&M, whoever they are, built the first temperature program gas chromatograph, and 1 year later, Perkin Elmer's 90% share went down to 25%, and these guys had the other 60%. And HP bought them.
Mm-hmm.
And HP has been dominant in that business ever since. Perkin Elmer's eventually built temperature program gas chromatograph. But because they did not recognize the technological importance of temperature programming of the GC, they kind of blew it.
Hmm.
So that's what happened.
Hmm.
I don't know what's happened to that business, whether it's, as far as Perkin Elmer is concerned, it's kind of a mystery to me.
Yeah, I don't know either.
But I do know that HP has done very well in it.
Where did the triple stage gas chromatograph happen in that?
Well, one of the things that they built the first gas chromatograph, they designed it, and Nat Brenner was involved with that, and I was sort of the head of applications engineering, so I was close to it too,
mm-hmm.
but didn't do an awful lot. But it occurred to me that one of the things they ought to do is to actually take the output from the gas chromatography column and then send it into another different column that would allow them to separate other components, and then even to a third column, so that you could end up with an analysis of a complex mixture such as gasoline,
mm-hmm.
where there might be hundreds or if not a thousand components, so you could separate them all out and then identify them. So I thought this was the way that gas chromatography might go, as one of the directions. So I designed or helped them design a triple column system, which is what that picture is.
Right.
And there were a number of those sold, but it was not it was in that same people who didn't understand temperature programming, because that's the way all gas chromatographs work nowadays. You send the stuff over here, and you might even have a liquid chromatograph, and they'll mix many separation methods. But they didn't understand that that was fundamentally where it had to go. I mean, you had this ability to separate, but you couldn't separate everything. You could send it back then into another column, which would separate it, or into a mass spectrometer, which is another kind of a separation device.
Right.
You could get tremendous ability to analyze a complex mixture. But they left that one go, and they didn't push the triple column system very much. There were a few of them sold, but I think they kind of, the people who were running the gas chromatography at that time, they were not very imaginative. They were more interested in the sales side than they were in the high technology side. So Marcel Golay kind of went away. They didn't use his know-how any longer, and that's basically what happened.
Who were those? Do you recall who the key decision makers were for the gas chromatography?
There were a variety of people who are very selling oriented and kept thinking of ways how could they can sell more and more, but they didn't want to change the design and obsolete their own design by making it different. I think that was basically it. So I think they were kind of salespeople as opposed to scientists, because they started with this empty plate.
Right. I guess I just have one last question, which would be about the ultraviolet story. When PerkinElmer got involved with ultraviolet spectrophotometry, and your involvement with that product line. Say a little bit about that. No, I don't know.
That's a painful one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
One of the things that I did was to, realizing that the Model 12C, they had a quartz prism that you could plug in, and then you could then make measurements in the ultraviolet invisible range that's existed. And so very few people did this. So I realized there was that quartz prism, and I had built these interchange units for all the different prisms, and I said, well, here's that quartz prism. Why don't I build an interchange unit, the quartz prism, and then make the Model 21 operate in the UV? So I built that, and I put in an ultraviolet source and a photomultiplier detector and a mirror flipper, and put in the ability to scan spectra as we did in the infrared. And Howard Carey was just introducing his double beam system at that time. So here was the PerkinElmer Model 21 UV, which I had designed. And I made it work. And I think published a paper on it or something. But in any event, I wanted to introduce this as a product. And Van Williams said, we don't know anything about ultraviolet spectroscopy, we're not going to touch it. And I said, well, I think we can learn. This is around 1956, 57, somewhere like that. I said, I think we can learn, and I've looked at other people's results, and I think that because we have this big prism, that we have about four or five times the resolution and the accuracy that can be achieved. So the project got killed. The design was done and ready to go, but they didn't activate it. Van Williams was uninterested. About 2 years later, he ran into a guy named Chuck Warren, who had his own company, and he built a double beam UV system attachment to the Beckman DU. And they thought this was wonderful. It's called the UltraCord or something. They thought this was wonderful, and so they bought the company, and then they gave Chuck Warren a whole bunch of engineers to productize that. As far as I know, it never worked. They introduced it, but it was couldn't compete with the carry. They had nothing to say about it. Whereas the Model 21U had a lot to say about it because it was much higher resolution and had this great big prism and was built into the 21 structure with the chart paper and everything, which had already been developed, and the ability to scan spectra. So we had an interchange unit with a quartz prism and the ability to operate in the UV, and I was very heavily involved in that. But that's the end of my story. Until I got involved with nanometrics, where we started doing UV invisible stuff. Mm. So that's an example of the kind of things that fall through the crack, things that don't happen.
Mm. I understand your wife has a family in Philadelphia, by the way.
Yes.
And are you?
She has a sister.
Are you planning on visiting Philadelphia in the near future?
Well, one of the things that I've thought about is when you guys get set up and so forth, that I want to stop by and see the display and so forth.
Well, we have a display already. We don't have we have the display that the revolutionary tools.
Yeah. Well, let me just.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I'll switch this off now. Yeah.